Good afternoon, buenas tardes. I'd like to start my talk today by giving you a very short case for how we can have open borders. And then a longer case, and then a slightly longer case. Earlier this year, I should say over the last few months, there's been a convergence of several things that I think make the case for why we need open borders and how we can achieve that under capitalism. Well, against capitalism, I should say. Sarah Nelson, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, representing nearly 50,000 flight attendants at 20 airlines, a few months ago threatened to conduct a national strike of her union to shut down the airports. That was in response to Trump's budget shutdown in order to cajole Congress, the Democrats, to give him the money he wanted for his wall expansion. After the threat of the national strike, within less than 2 days, the Trump administration conceded. About the same time, educational and healthcare workers in Honduras began to organize against the privatization of public health services and education services in their country, against a very brutal government, a coup government led by someone named Juan Orlando Hernandez, a US-supported government. And in the last few months, we've seen the organized workers there playing a central role in leading an uprising, calling for the overthrow of Hernandez. One of their national marches concluded at the US Embassy there, where they burned trash in the doorway of the US Embassy. And they said, US out. Yankees fuera. They're very clear in terms of who is responsible for the imposition of their dictatorship on them. And they're very clear that the Trump administration is putting their brothers and sisters in cages. About the same time, Mexican workers at over 50 maquiladoras, primarily concentrated in the northern state of Tamaulipas, shut down car production in North America by going on strike in plants that produce much of the auto parts that make it into the final assemblies of cars in places like Detroit and other parts of the US. 50,000 workers shut down this crucial supply chain, most of which are owned by US subsidiaries of larger corporations operating in Mexico, and they won every single one of their strikes within a fairly short period of time. Yeah. Most recently, 500 workers at Wayfair, an online furniture company, walked out of their headquarters to protest the sale of beds, basically, to the migrant camps and detention centers, carrying out a wildcat and demanding that their employer not fulfill contracts with those companies that provide, fulfill contracts with the US government for putting furniture in detention centers. So these four examples happening almost simultaneously, I think, illustrate the power of the working class internationally to devote energy in different directions at the same time towards why we need to get rid of borders. Okay, that's my short version. So now I want to give a slightly longer version of my case, the case for why we need open borders. And I'm going to look specifically at the United States and Mexico, the border between the US and Mexico. And I'm going to talk mostly about Mexico. Although, you know, much of what I say was going to apply also to Central America. The global crisis of 1973, let me start by saying we need class analysis. We have to start with a class analysis. The global economic crisis of 1973 was a turning point in many ways internationally for capitalism. It was a turning point for US capitalism. Increased global competition, colossal military spending, industrial disinvestment, stagnation and falling rates of profit, etc., compelled a capitalist reorganization in the US and subsequently on an international scale. This further intensified after the fall of the Soviet Union, which has given way to the regionalization of global capitalism into kind of blocks. And so the North American Free Trade Agreement is a reflection of this. After the US ruling class lost its capacity to increase accumulation vis-a-vis its competitors through organic expansion, for example, access to new territories and resources, technological innovations and superiority, productivity gains, etc., it gradually embraced a more aggressive method to extract more surplus value from its subordinate client states in North America and the working classes, North and Central America, I should say, and back at home against the its own working class. So on the one hand, they have relied on expanding US power through naked military power, the remaking of the Middle East and all that. But I'm gonna focus more on how they have relied on other forms to increase their means for accumulation in North America. More specific to this talk, how they have engaged in open class warfare to account and compensate for the decline and for their decline and their ability to accumulate profits on the same scale. Over the last four decades, they have unrelentlessly attacked all provisions and institutions that protect workers and their basic rights to engage in collective struggle against them, the capitalist class. This is generally referred to as the epoch of neoliberal capitalist restructuring. The US has expanded direct control over Mexico and over Central America, overturning economic developmentalist policies through different external and internal forms, including new capitalist class formation and reorganization through mass privatization, which is social theft, privatizing state enterprises, taking the public, what was invested with public money and handing it over to private investors. And through this new class formation through privatization in Mexico and Central America, they've extended a kind of partnership that has allowed and facilitated the creation of a regional US-centric economy. So NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, are the kind of these agreements that represent how this new sort of regionally integrated economy has developed. And really, it's about access to markets. It's about opening up Mexico and Central America to US capital. It's about access to resources, extractive industries, etc. But most importantly, it's the long-term access and control of labor. The main reason, well, if we look at Mexico, there are 55 million workers. I mean, there's millions that have already crossed in the last few decades. But there are 55 million workers who make an average minimum wage of about roughly $6 to $8 a day. The border allows this labor to be contained, while displacement factors associated with US capitalist penetration into these economies also allows for there to be displaced workers who migrate. The border then allows for them to be criminalized once they enter the United States. Global capital investment in 2017 was nearly $1.5 trillion, with $671 billion flowing into developing countries and $712 billion pouring into developed countries. So we see investment is happening in both categories. This free flow of capital is facilitated by trade rules, agreements, and treaties that favor the movement of capital They're basically laws that create free mobility of capital while simultaneously restricting mobility of labor and displaced peoples. Of the existing 288 free trade agreements recorded by the World Trade Organization, only 40 of them say anything about rights of labor to cross borders. And when they do, it's usually in terms of allowing highly specialized skilled labor to cross, or guest worker programs, or means by which people can cross temporarily to perform an economic function, but not remain permanently in the countries in which they're being imported into. Meanwhile, the global 1%, the richest people, they move through a completely different set of visas. We call that golden visas, right? Basically, money allows you to move very freely. And of course, most people in the wealthy part of the world, and within those countries, the wealthier people, move freely in poor countries, right? So the ability to move is very much determined by how much money you have, where you live, and then where you live, how much money you have. So my point is that borders exist exclusively for the world's working classes, whether as labor migrants, displaced peoples, or refugees. The repression of migrants and the criminalization of migration is now a global phenomenon. There are about 300 million denationalized people, people who have been forced to leave their countries where they were born, and who now comprise what Karl Marx called a, quote, floating reserve army of labor. In North America, where the process has been the most systematized in the last three decades, the U.S. state has been militarizing migration, first at the border, then internally, now externally, through what is referred to as low-intensity warfare tactics against people who are displaced. Using specially armed bodies to overlay control over displaced people, not only in the US, but now through the corridors of migration, through Mexico, all the way into Central America. This is in order, I argue, to control worker mobility, to contain a transnational reserve army of labor within a regionally segmented and tiered economy to maximize the extraction of surplus value. So there are people in Honduras, well, first, just in the last few days, the U.S. announced a regional security pact in which U.S. armed agents will now be allowed to control the borders. Really what that means is the traditional crossing points, because the borders are not fully policed, only the places where it's safest to cross. So in the next year or so, we'll begin to see deployments of troops in Honduras along the border, along Guatemala, and along El Salvador. So part of the function of that will be to keep people in El Salvador, in Honduras, for example, which is the largest supplier of garment exports to the United States in the region, so that are owned primarily by U.S. companies. People who cross will be integrated into Mexico to some degree, or try to make it to the United States. And we see that Mexico is now, well, it has been, but as part of this, it's increased the militarization of its own borders. The government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador recently deployed 20,000 troops, several thousand to the southern border and around the southern region of Mexico, and several thousand to the northern border. Mexico has already deported about 60,000 Central Americans, and of course 200,000 more have come through Mexico and are now in concentration camps in the U.S. But a lot of Central Americans will stay in Mexico and enter into the workforce there. So the militarization regulates this process in which labor is migration and mobility is controlled and facilitates its distribution along a regionally segmented economy. And then, of course, in the United States, This process continues with the way undocumented people are policed, how they're integrated into the economy, specifically in tiers, lower tiers that are now almost wholly undocumented immigrant. So these are the kind of byproducts of that. Migrant workers are also leveraged in each country. Well, in Mexico and the United States, they're leveraged by their criminalization against national workers in existing industry clusters. So there have been efforts in the most recent immigration bills that haven't passed, but in the wording of them, there has been discussion about how we need to open new sectors of the economy to undocumented immigrants. Well, they don't say undocumented, but the idea is that part of the legalization will be to to facilitate the expansion of workers who are legalized into the different parts of the economy. But the trick is that legalization in its last manifestation is a 10 to 15 year process in which workers have virtually, the sort of legalized workers have virtually no rights and can be still denied a citizenship and deported during that 10 to 15 year process. So it's a very skillfully crafted sort of set of policies that whose end consequence are very profitable for capital. So my argument is that borders have been eliminated for U.S. capital. Not only have borders been eliminated, but the state functions to facilitate capital flows and facilitate profitability, both by pushing for free trade agreements and by criminalizing immigrants within national boundaries. There is a U.S.-centric, regionally integrated economy in which large parts of Mexico and Central America are extensions of the U.S. economy in terms of production, distribution, and supply chains, which a regionally fused capitalist class. So there's this kind of region-wide capitalist class. Of course, the U.S. capitalist class dominates these relationships, but it's also the Mexican capitalist class, the Honduran, the Guatemalan have profited immensely from this as well. Okay. So the recent militancy I talked about, in terms of workers in all of these countries directly or indirectly fighting against the criminalization of immigrant labor, shows that, especially in Mexico and Honduras, that socialist and class consciousness as part of sort of cultural and historical memory persists in the working class. And in my experiences in Mexico, and my experiences working with immigrant workers, and my experiences having discussions with people from different parts of this region, socialist politics are much more deeply rooted. The collective forms of struggle and a memory in which people as a class fight back, is part of this. And if you look at Honduras, for instance, if you pay attention to what's happening there, you'll see the level of class consciousness in terms of how they talk about class struggle. This being in the context of class struggle is very impressive. But where it doesn't exist, it's being reborn because of the conditions of oppression that exist on all sides of these borders. So this is basically creating the basis, however we identify the starting point, in which trans-border solidarity and even trans-border organization can be rebuilt. So what does it mean to actually open the border? Well, there are very practical aspects to this. It doesn't mean like in the fantasy of the right wing or even amongst liberals or people who live in fear of the very idea that we open the border. It doesn't mean that we flip a light switch, right? And then there are just people lined up ready to go. Most of the people who've migrated already have migrated. In fact, there's been a higher rate of migration out of the United States in the last few years in terms of people fleeing the housing market. And I live in San Diego. There's a lot of people that have fled the San Diego housing market because they can't afford to live there anymore. They live in Tijuana. There's like, it's a fluctuating population, but 750,000 to 1 million U.S. citizens living in Mexico. It's the largest undocumented population in Mexico. Although, of course, no gringo would ever say they're undocumented. They're expatriates. So what does it mean to open the border? Well, it means we build on and continue the struggle and expand the struggle against the repression of immigrants, of immigrant labor, in the immediate here and now. It means we close the concentration camps by organizing directly against them. And by building a movement that puts a fire under the asses of the pretend Democratic Party candidates who are, I say pretend because right after the first series of Democratic Party debates, I don't know if you know this, but most of them went to a detention center in Florida in order to sort of check the box that, you know, we're against this, we're outraged by it, even though their party is complicit in this from the very beginning. And even though at the same time they were doing this, Democrats in Congress gave Trump a basically blank check to build the concentration camps even more. So it means we have to do all these things. It means we have to organize immigrants into unions, or I should say, recognize the way in which immigrants are fighting to be in unions and resist the political tendencies within the labor movement to exclude them. It means we have to organize transnationally, and it means we have to fight to weaken capitalism on a transnational scale through strikes, the building of new revitalized labor movements, which is we currently see happening in Mexico with the maquiladora workers have formed their own political party, and there's several different independent unions that are being built, and to a lesser extent with what we see with the signs of life, right, in terms of opposing the border wall by the workers in the airlines, and the solidarity that we've seen in, to some degree with labor unions and the people in the camps. So fighting the oppression is the basis for opening the border for workers. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about social class and class formation in the context of this political moment, and how we can begin to understand the region of, I'm focusing here primarily on US and Mexico, but the larger region, as one in which both a capitalist class and a working class is being constructed transnationally. Michael C. Drilling describes the modern U.S. ruling class in these terms. Class formation is thus a consequence of converging concentrations of capital in large corporations and the social overlap of these corporations and their executives in multiple institutional spheres. From a class perspective, an inner circle whose collective outlook is generated from a unique structural level spanning numerous institutions, corporations, and state agencies nests within the most interlocked sectors of the most influential corporations. In this period, the fortunes of the U.S. ruling class intersect directly with the maintenance and the further retrenchment of borders. Whether the neoliberal wing or the neoliberal sections that need borders to disempower labor, or the right-wing nationalist, quasi-proto-fascist wings that need to deflect the failings of capitalism through the criminalization, the racial criminalization of migrants. The commanding heights of the U.S. capitalist class organized itself into a PAC in the late 1980s, a political action committee called U.S. NAFTA. This grouping included the top 300 of the biggest corporations and hundreds of others, and investor groups based in the United States, and spent an estimated 30 to 50 million to, this doesn't seem like much now, but back then it was a lot, to vigorously lobby for NAFTA, making it among the most expensive foreign policy campaigns in US history at the time. That successful coalition, which brought together the main wings of the Democratic Party and Republican Party that pushed NAFTA through, was over the heads of significant opposition. NAFTA has became so important that the coalition that developed out of that then proceeded to grow and push for the passage of the World Trade Organization a year later to project this kind of neoliberal capitalist model on an international scale. And so the profitability, the way in which NAFTA and CAFTA and then amplified through the global system, through the WTO, it has tremendously expanded the wealth of the 1%, and immiserated millions and millions of workers at the same time. So I'm old enough to remember this period, and the number of billionaires was still relatively small, by U.S. standards. Most of the billionaire, we have like 607 billionaires, I think that's the latest count, and most of them develop, most of them become billionaires between 2000 and like the last two decades. But we see a dramatic increase related to these policies, and the NAFTA being the sort of centerpiece of that for the U.S. capitalist class, or the starting point. So between 1993 to 2015, the United States real gross domestic product grew 39%. Canada's grew 40% and Mexico's grew 24%. Of course, on a proportional scale, this was the largest amount of wealth occurred in the United States. But I point that out because most of that wealth went to this top 1%. In the United States, over that period, wages largely stagnated, which puts the context of the fight for 15 into historical perspective, where people had to fight to basically raise the wages to a point where you could only, instead of suffering across the board, you could maybe pay 2 out of 3 bills, right? Wages in Mexico stayed flat. So between 1993 and 2015, even though there was 24% growth in the overall economy, wages stayed virtually the same. So this was a period of massive wealth accumulation. As I mentioned, the number of billionaires increased. I had a slide, but I was informed that there's no slides, there's no projection. So imagine, if you will, a slide. But I had this slide that went way up, starting in the 90s, in terms of number of billionaires. Something like 100 US billionaires in the US, around 100 or less in 1990, and now there's 600. So. Since NAFTA, Mexico has, with this growth, it's the third lowest growth rate in all of Latin America over that period of time. So, the way in which success is framed, right, completely ignores reality. The passage of NAFTA, along with the privatization of state industry and the privatization of the land, was devastating for the working and middle classes of Mexico. But it was also a catalyst for the explosive accumulation of vast fortunes in that country. Between 1989 and 1993, the dominant faction of the Mexican ruling class, because it was not united around this, the dominant faction paid $25 million to promote the passage of NAFTA, hiring a phalanx of Washington law firms, lobbyists, public relations companies, and consultants. It actually required a kind of a civil war in Mexican politics. The 1989 election was stolen, and every election is stolen, but the 1989 election was really stolen, and people were mobilized and upset about it. And that So the Civil War expressed itself in violence, where people were assassinated within the political parties, including Luis Donaldo Colosio. I won't go into it, but he was assassinated in Tijuana. And the PRI, which was the dominant political party, kind of split ultimately into three parties, right? The Party of the Democratic Revolution, which was initially critical of NAFTA, and then later not. And then most recently, I would argue that Morena, because AMLO was once affiliated with the PRI, Morena's kind of like a new manifestation of the sort of, a section of the opposition from 1989 that represents a different, to some degree, a different set of capitalists, but in reality has made its peace with this arrangement, at least so far. While that was happening in the ruling class, there was massive suppression of the, there's been nonstop massive suppression of the Mexican people. It's never stopped. Mexico is a cemetery, not only for, as a result of drug violence, but it's a cemetery for women. There's an extremely high rate of murders of women, especially working women. To be an activist, there's constant assassinations, there's journalists. I mean, it's really a horrible place to try to fight for justice. And of course, the Ayotzinapa, the disappearance of the students who were fighting against some of the budget cuts that they were facing. Prior to NAFTA, Mexico had only one billionaire. This changed during the government of Miguel de la Madrid from 1982 to 1988, and Carlos Salinas de Gortari from 1988 to 1994. The number of state-owned enterprises just during those two administrations fell from nearly 1,200 state-owned enterprises across the every industry to less than 200. And during the six-year period of Carlos Salinas de Gortari alone, 23 billionaires were added to the ranks, primarily through the selling to themselves for pennies or nothing the privately owned state enterprises, in many cases then selling them off to U.S. investors or taking that kind of original accumulation and then making fortunes off it, like Carlos Slim. You name a rich person in Mexico, they'll be traced for the most part to this massive sell-off. And these industries had embedded within them hundreds of billions of dollars of public money. So this was a huge giveaway. According to the 2008 UBS La Banca Suiza Billionaires Report on Wealth in Mexico, they said, the past 30 years has seen a wealth creation much greater than the Golden Age. Generations of families in the United States and Europe were forged in that period, and they influenced business, banking, politics, philanthropy, and the arts for more than 100 years. With the wealth that will pass from the current entrepreneurs to their heirs in the coming years, the multi-generational families of the 21st century are being created. Honduras, a country of 9 million people with a GDP of $22 billion, recently announced its first billionaire. Guatemala, a country of 16 million, not much larger in GDP, also has a billionaire. And these are in two countries where officially about 70% of the population live in poverty, what in the United States would be extreme poverty. So to put that into perspective in terms of this wealth transfer. Okay, I want to talk about working class formation in Mexico, because this kind of gets to how I would argue the basis by which trans-border organization is becoming more, the need for it becoming more obvious. Mexico has been thoroughly economically recolonized or re-semi-colonized by U.S. capital. It's reached a point now that is reminiscent of the period right before the Mexican Revolution in terms of how much U.S. control over that economy exists. This is through multinational corporations, investment regimes, etc. Across most sectors, through buyout, merger, displacement, etc., U.S. capital is majority or at least involved. That includes manufacturing, finance, agriculture, retail, insurance, media, telecommunications, technology, and more. Same in Central America. This links large sections of both the US and Mexican working classes. It links them together on the same production lines and the same distribution nodes, or working directly or indirectly for the same companies and having the same bosses. For instance, in the auto industry, Mexico has become a key destination for US investment, where wages there are approximately 80% lower than they are in the US. Just in the last 10 years, US auto companies have invested $10 billion in new facilities there. This includes actual car production facilities, but also the supply chain, maquiladoras, these places where products for the cars are made, like steering wheel columns and parts that will fit in either in Mexico, but more likely in the finished cars in the United States. They also service other car auto internationals. There are over 800,000 of these workers in Mexico that work in the auto industry, either by making cars or making the parts. So, in other words, the average GM car will be a car that was likely made by Mexican and US workers, right? Also, if it's Toyota or Volkswagen, it'll be made by Japanese or German and US and Mexican workers. So looking at the export production, supply chain production as a whole, so that those sectors within the Mexican economy which produce for predominantly US markets, there are about 4.6 million workers in Mexico that produce, again, many of them working. It's complex because the subsidiary process is very murky, but most of these workers work for US subsidiary companies, and they're producing for US markets. So this brings me back to the strike of the maquiladora workers, because these 50,000, there's roughly about 300,000 to 400,000 of these auto workers who work in auto part production. In one highly concentrated state of Tamaulipas, 50,000 of them shut down 50 of these auto parts production facilities. And so if you think of those parts going out to either Mexico City or South Carolina or other places where cars are being produced, that shutdown created the potential for the shutting down of the auto sectors. And so this is why in Mexico, a country where strikes have been suppressed in so many different ways, why they could win 50 strikes in a month, almost practically to the one winning significant demands. Walmart has 2.3 million workers worldwide, 1.4 million in the US, and over 230,000 in Mexico. In Mexico, 60,000 of the Walmart workers are union, not like here, where none of them are. It's interesting because in Mexico, they were under kind of fake union contracts, but as a result of the maquiladora workers rising up, also working under fake union contracts, they went to their union, their fake union leader, and they said, be a real union leader, we're gonna throw your ass out of here. I mean, literally, they went to their offices and threatened to physically throw them out of their offices. And so it's interesting to see how quickly these fake union leaders suddenly become militant, when 1,000 workers are about to... Anyways, so Walmart, which has vowed never to negotiate with a union, said, we're not gonna give you your wage increase, and this was back in March, and they the unionized workers said, okay, we're shutting down Walmarts in several states of Mexico. Walmart buckled. And apparently now Walmart negotiates with unions. Somebody should tell the Walmart workers here. But the point is that Walmart workers here are struggling to get a union, right? And so the connection's obvious. Okay, so I have to move forward here to conclude. In the United States, between 1994 and 2008, about 7 million people left Mexico for the United States. This is also the sort of result of these economic changes. Displaced farmers, farm workers, the shutting down of much of the state-owned economy had devastating impacts. The competition with the U.S. and China through NAFTA eliminated whole sectors of the sort of native manufacturing. And so we see the sort of, as Juan Gonzalez calls it, the harvest of empire, right? The millions of people from Mexico, Central America, and other parts of the hemisphere coming to the United States to look for work. If we look at Mexicans alone, there's 39 million Mexican descendant people. I'm fourth generation, but there are a lot more who are first generation born in the United States. There's 11.2 million Mexican born people in the United States. If we lump all the people who migrated into one category, or if we include naturalized, undocumented, we're looking at something like at least a quarter of the workforce. And so this also helps, I think, contextualize how repression works here in terms of this being a growing part of the working class. It's younger, it's productive, and it's concentrated in important industries. Going back to that sort of understanding of how criminalization serves capital, maintaining this section of the workforce as a vulnerable and targeted population for immigration enforcement sort of fits into this model. Okay, I was gonna talk a little bit about Plan Mérida because I think it's important I'll just summarize this really quickly and get to my conclusion. It's important to understand the way in which policy, especially bipartisan, much of the infrastructure of immigration repression, whether domestically or internationally, spans multiple administrations. These are developed policies that begin under one administration but grow under the next, regardless of who's in power. And Plan Mérida is this sort of this ongoing regional security plan in which the United States has helped cultivate through aid and through political support. It's done two things. One is it's allowed for the U.S. to actually begin to bring troops into Mexico and Central America. It's armed the police and military forces of these countries. It's not just Mexico, there's a component of it that extends to the allies in Central America. For instance, part of Plan Mérida was to fund the militarization of the southern border in Mexico. We see that happening. We also see part of the funding now going to extending border militarization into the Central American sending nations themselves. This is an ongoing fund, it plays a significant role in facilitating the sort of region-wide militarization. Okay, so let me conclude by talking about open borders. So as I mentioned, the practical part of this is to fight for equal rights, to fight for the dismantling of the repressive apparatus, and understanding why it exists as a way to repress immigrants, but also weaken the labor movement as a whole. The last time there was an amnesty in this country, 1986, it was a kind of devil's bargain because it allowed for a couple million people to become naturalized citizens, amnesty. It also contained within it the first provisions that allowed for immigrant repression to take place at the point of production. That was the, so in other words, it, it required that workers show Social Security in order to work, and it also contained the first provisions about how we need to start stopping migrants at the border. But the 2.5 million who were legalized, most of them Mexican, but also Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean, and people from different parts, you know, of North America, North Central and Central America and the Caribbean, they joined unions because they were concentrated heavily in certain industries in which they fought within the unions that existed to include them, and attained positions that then leveraged resources to then organize in their communities. And so I have this beautiful graph. Again, imagine, come with me. It's the sad part is that you see unionization declining, and then between like 1987 and 1991, you see a little uptick because hundreds of thousands of naturalized citizens, probably several hundred thousand, joined unions. And that is what the ruling class learned, is that we can't afford that anymore because it changed their trajectory of immigration politics. And speaking very quickly here, it led to the establishment of networks within the immigrant concentrated unions to begin to build a political movement. First, to change the whole AFL-CIO's position on immigrants, which was still backwards, restrictive, anti-immigrant, which occurred in 2000. That was when the union movement in this country said, okay, we now agree that we need to organize undocumented immigrants. By 2003, there was a nationwide movement that called itself the Freedom Rides for Immigrants that was calling for a new amnesty, general amnesty without criminalization. There's a correlation between expanding rights for immigrants and the growth and confidence and militancy of the labor movement as a whole. And we saw this again in 2006 when the inertia from the movement that I had previously talked about came up against an attempt to clamp down very hard on immigrants with the passage of a bill in 2005 called the Sensenbrenner-King Bill, which would have made it a felony to be undocumented in the United States. And between March and May of 2006, over 3 million people went out on strike or marched or walked out of schools and collectively refused to buy things, generally called a day without an immigrant, one of the largest mass strikes in modern US history. And we see the further clampdown on immigrants and unfortunately the retreat of the unions away from defending them. So I'm absolutely concluding right now. So this is class struggle. And there have been instances of this before, which I won't go into, but we could talk about in terms of periods of US history where there has been transnational solidarity and organizing. But I'll just finish with a few sentences. We have to rebuild a mass working class movement that can fight for opening the borders, starting with defending immigrants, as I mentioned. The front line for this movement will take place in the unions, both in terms of leveraging the critical mass of the working class and developing a political clarity that will be needed to engage, you know, ideologically in the current political milieu, which is from the top down anti-immigrant. This will need to be led by socialists. And it will need to recognize the importance of not acting on behalf of immigrants, but acting in solidarity with, and in many cases taking cues and building solidarity with the struggles that already exist. And so these are formulas that are challenging and complex in order to figure out, you know, exactly how we're going to do this, but I think the conditions are such in which we could be at the beginning point in which this is possible. Thank you.